This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Mothers Against Drunk Driving National President Helen Witte says we don't know enough about marijuana and driving.
A lot of states are legalizing this drug before all the research is out there.
And a survey by State Farm Insurance shows 1 in 8 adults admits to driving under the influence of marijuana. Plus, hear from the Democratic candidate in the very red 18th Congressional District. Attorney George Petrilli talks health care and safe seats. And hear about hanging loose and staying resilient amid the stress of the pandemic. Not that easy, is it? All that and a news update on the way. This is Sound Ideas on WGLT.
Support for the Sound Ideas podcast comes from WGLT listeners. Join the community of informed news consumers who listen to WGLT and also support it financially. Learn more about how you can support WGLT's nonprofit public service mission at WGLT.org.
This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Let's run down some of the day's top stories. Bloomington Mayor Terry Renner says the city is waiting on guidance from state public health officials before deciding whether to endorse Halloween trick-or-treating. The pandemic has ironically put a holiday in jeopardy in which everyone already wears masks. Renner says he'd hate to call for a reduced Halloween, but it might be necessary.
Are people still going to go door-to-door if we say, you know, we would like to have alternative means? We're not going to go and start issuing tickets for people who go door to door. It's just it certainly is not something that we're going to be sanctioning officially.
Renner says the city wants to stop people from gathering in large groups. Whatever the plan, he says, Bloomington wants to be on the same page as normal. The McLean County Health Department has reported 8 new cases of COVID-19. Right now, 178 people are isolating at home. No one is in intensive care. 9 people are in the hospital. The rolling positivity rate is 2.8% over the last week. The city of Bloomington is getting $2.3 million federal dollars to remove lead from nearly 100 housing units. Bloomington pediatrician Samina Youssef says lead-based paint is still a problem in many older neighborhoods, even though the government banned its use 40 years ago.
The fact that we have this many houses, and there's probably even more in our area that still contain possibility of lead exposure to our young children is obviously very concerning.
Lead poisoning can stunt a child's physical and mental development. The Illinois Department of Public Health lists 9 McLean County zip codes as high risk for lead poisoning in kids, including 61701 in Bloomington and 8 others in eastern McLean County. Illinois Wesleyan University athletics coaches and administrators say they want to remove the stigma that mental health issues often have in sports. Women's lacrosse coach Lindsay Keller is leading a new mental health initiative to give student athletes help. She says the campaign includes educating coaches on what to look for.
Someone who struggles with mental health can still be mentally tough and still learn mental toughness strategies on the field. And I think that that's where there's probably an unclear line for people of knowing what that difference is.
An athletic department committee plans to offer activities and resources for student athletes. Keller says the campaign was in the works before the pandemic, but the COVID-19 has shown how much it is needed. This is Sound Ideas on 89.1 FM, WGLT and WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. Democrat George Petrilli says the way the 18th Congressional District is carved up makes it too safe for a Republican to win, and that means there's never an opportunity to really talk about the issues. He's trying anyway. Petrilli will challenge Republican incumbent Darren LaHood this fall in a district that includes parts of Peoria, Bloomington Normal, and Springfield. LaHood did not respond to repeated requests for an interview or to join a WGLT candidates forum with Petrilli. Petrilli tells Ryan Denham he's a Springfield native and lawyer who only became the Democratic choice on the ballot over the summer.
I think Central Illinois is a lot like a lot of different areas of the country where we have some small cities and rural areas, and a lot of the issues that are going on with rural areas right now with healthcare and lack of economic opportunities, you're starting to see what is middle and small town America not be able to be in anymore. It's not able to survive. Economically, you see people that grew up in those areas need to leave when they go to college or to seek job opportunities. They can't really come back because there's not a lot of economic opportunity there, any growth or any opportunity for growth, and the government is not initiating policies that allow for growth to be sustainable in small and rural areas. Some of the trade issues and policies that we see have driven small and family-owned farms, they start to become less and less sufficient for the long term. So you have families that can't have or can't rely anymore on multi-generational practice of their farming.
So what's an example of where federal policymaking has come up short for rural parts of the 18th district?
Sure. And I think it stretches several different areas. The first one that I think we should address is healthcare. Healthcare for people right now is a bottleneck on the economy. People that want to build businesses, expand businesses, start businesses, people that want to change jobs, to change careers, are really held back by the idea of losing healthcare or losing coverage on pre-existing conditions for themselves or for their family. That question of whether or not I should change my job, get a new job, expand my business because of healthcare costs is a real drag on the economy, especially in areas of Central Illinois, small rural areas, small cities, where you don't have a very expansive market to go into for jobs. So, large cities, Chicago, St. Louis, New York, Los Angeles, you have a larger market where you can go and you can compete for jobs and compete for packages that include benefits. But in smaller areas, you might be stuck in a job. You may be in a state job and you may want to start a business, but you don't feel like you can because you have to have that insurance. That insurance is your lifeline. And I don't think we should have insurance tied to a job. I don't think we should have insurance tied to your income. I think we need to have insurance that is a guaranteed right for people, and I believe that it is.
Does that mean that you support then a single payer model, a universal healthcare?
I am, but not immediately because of the way that our, so initially what I'll state is that I don't believe for-profit healthcare system works at all. I don't believe it has a place in our economy and it should not. And I've stated this before that I believe anybody that says that it's a good model or that it's a working model or somehow is a better model is either misinformed or they're misinforming others. They're either lying or they don't know what they're really stating, because the design of a model for profit for healthcare. And so I have an economics degree and I believe in our capitalist economic system and what that can do as far as competition for growth, for development of new technologies. All of that is wonderful, but the healthcare system is not a place where we need to have capitalistic determination on market qualities. And by that, I mean, you can see it in rural areas. You can go to low income areas and you can see the level of care is not the same and it will never be the same because those areas are never going to be as profitable. So you are going to see a minimal amount of effort, a minimal amount of care, and it's going to continue to reduce. And anybody in a rural area that's been sick, how long does it take to get to a doctor? How far away is the hospital?
Student loan debt is something that you've talked a lot about. What is your vision of a way forward there to bring that debt load under control?
Student loan debt is not secured by a piece of real estate. So even if it had less value, that real estate can't transfer hands. You can't transfer your college degree. So we have this massive debt issue that's coming up. And also with that, we see students that move back home, that take jobs just to pay their student loan debt or take jobs in government so that they think they might be able to forgive the rest of that loan in 10 years. And we've seen that rate of student loan forgiveness in public service. The rejection rate is actually in the 90s, which is somewhat absurd, which needs to be investigated itself. But I presented a program a number of years ago through the ISBA, and that just specifically with lawyers, that would allow attorneys to, and this could, what I want to do is expand this, the whole concept out to anybody that has a student loan debt, to be able to make their monthly payment with pro bono and social service work. And so for attorneys, the way that would work traditionally, you can have an appointed attorney in a criminal matter and you're constitutionally allowed to that, but not for a civil matter. So if somebody sees a social injustice or suffers one, as of right now, they can't afford an attorney or they can't find an attorney who feels like it's worthwhile to put money into on a contingent basis. They don't have access essentially to the legal system. They don't have representation that's willing to do that for them. And I think if we empower people to work for the community, to work for people directly by essentially making investments in the community, by allowing people to pay student loan debt through that type of work. And functionally how that would work is you would have probably just designated 501c3s within desired areas that worked in the community or provided a service. Another example being of teachers. If they wanted to tutor after school at-risk children or children that were falling behind or they knew weren't getting the education they needed or they weren't catching on to concepts, you could allow them to tutor, have the principal write off on the number of hours they did on what student that student qualified, and they could submit that as payment for their student loan for that month. And again, as the economy's declined, we're going to see the recourse of this, of less and less and less money for social service programs and people that are at risk, the cycle of poverty, that continues is going to be even worse and worse and worse. And I don't, and from my perspective, you see some of the worst school districts in the country have some of the most money spent per student. So money necessarily isn't the issue, but I think getting people that are skilled, that are talented, that are educated, and motivate them to basically give services to the community that are badly needed.
The incumbent in the 18th district is Darren LaHood, a Republican. What do you make of his tenure so far in Congress?
I think there's different approaches to representation for elected officials. There's, and I would almost boil them down to sort of passive representation and active representation. And that's the issues that I have with Congressman LaHood. I just don't think he's active. I think if anybody goes and looks up his record congressionally, he's presented very few, if any, of his own initiatives. I don't hear him talk about anything as far as how to solve any problems. And in fact, some of the mailers that people have showed me that he doesn't even want to identify that they're problems. I mean, to talk about, we can get a little bit more into it, but to say that systematic racism is only a question of whether you support Black Lives Matter or the police is not identifying what's going on in our society. It's an absolute refusal to do it. And I know when you get into congressional campaigns, when we try to get reelected, it's probably easier to simplify things to figure out where the division is, figure out who's on what side, figure out what votes you can have, and just go with it. And that's what I think a lot of people do in Congress. And that's not something I do.
You talk a lot about gerrymandering. Do you think that the way the 18th congressional district has been gerrymandered, you know, it's sprawling from Bloomington Normal to parts of Peoria to Springfield to Lincoln all the way west toward Macomb. Do you think that gerrymandering has done a disservice to voters?
Absolutely. And that's sort of exactly what I was saying on that is when you have a party, essentially one party or the other, that knows that they can always win a district, you're never going to get the full attention of that elected official on what the specific issues are because they have no motivation to do so.
George, I think it's safe to say that you are the underdog in this race. This is not perceived to be a very competitive race here in the 18th district. You know, given that reality, what is it that you hope to accomplish here by making a run?
Well, so, and this is also more difficult too, because I was just appointed to the ballot in June because the Democratic primary candidate had to drop out. So now I have, a district heavily drawn Republican, short time, COVID period, you know, all those things, no name recognition. The real reason too, like I said, is when I see all these problems not being addressed and not even being identified as problems, somebody needs to speak up on it. And when 2016, when everybody noticed how polarized the country seemed to be, I really thought what that would do would motivate a lot of people that typically would shy away from politics to get involved. And I've actually seen that out campaigning, talking to other candidates, talking to people why they got involved, first-time candidates in local races. And I think it is that people are really fed up and feel like they can't be quiet anymore because it's so important. And to me, bringing up these issues, telling people in this district, I know that there is a problem here, and helping bring that up on a local level and also district-wide is almost as important as even winning this election, is to hopefully start with that momentum to get the conversation started on some of these issues. So even not being successful in the election in a traditional way by having more votes than the other person, I consider this successful just by the fact of identifying these problems and saying we need to solve these, we need to help fix these. And for the people that feel frustrated and alienated, to show them that there are people out there that know that this is a problem, that we can fix these problems as long as we actually making a point to say that they are there and that we need to start talking about some of the solutions to them.
That's 18th Congressional District Democratic candidate George Petrelli with Ryan Denham. Find more of that interview at WGLT.org. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. It's times of great distress that test us, you know, like a pandemic. Whether we pass the test or even survive it is shaped largely by our resilience. The concept of resilience in families will be in focus today at the Women to Women Giving Circle Virtual Fall Forum. The speaker this year is Dara Williamson with the early childhood group Ounce of Prevention. She tells Ryan Denham, a family's resilience is tied to the supportive relationships it has in the wider world.
Individuals, families, communities, groups of people have experienced traumas for as long as we know. but yet people continue to move forward and grow and find ways to thrive. So thinking about why is that? Why do some individuals or communities, groups of people, rise out of trauma and into successful, you know, finding success and I guess strong and healthy coping mechanisms after experiencing things that are really traumatic. And what we know about brain development in early child in early childhood, in particular, is that all experiences shape brain development, whether those are positive experiences or whether those are highly stressful, toxic trauma experiences.
Okay, so resilience, we shouldn't think of it as some static character trait. It's actually something that evolves, develops over time.
Exactly, yes. Relationships kind of come and go. People come in and out of our life, and new relationships help or can help build new coping or resiliency, or at least allowing us to see a new perspective, which can help shape our thinking, which can then help shape our response and understanding of events in our life.
So Karen Major, let's bring you into the conversation. You're with the Baby Fold and also a member of the Women to Women Giving Circle Steering Committee. So last year's Fall Forum, you know, was in this space too, talking about childhood trauma, and now you're focused on resilience. So what is it that you want people to take away from that kind of conversation?
If you're a part of a church or you're a part of a social service organization or you're a part of a group that can help understand and even inject some supports or services through your church or whatever into families who don't otherwise maybe have those opportunities for role models or access to resources or whatever. Just a community awareness about how extended families or churches or coaches or teachers can be that source of resilience to help lift up a child, to help them understand and be successful in a way that I think a lot of us don't really understand.
How does the pandemic weigh on all of this? How does that shape and reshape these notions of resilience and what a family can develop to protect themselves?
We're seeing so much more the disparities, the income disparities, as families are having to either shelter in place or children are part of remote learning and they don't have access to the technology they need in order to be successful. Families who might otherwise have been involved with their church or involved with social service organizations are now not having access to those support systems. So we're seeing more food insecurity, we're seeing more healthcare challenges, we're seeing a lack of supportive services. And for some families, and I don't want to get into more of the trauma stuff, but for some families, substance abuse has increased, and with all the social distancing and the threat of the virus, there aren't as many eyes and ears on some families as there used to be. So that creates more of a challenge for those families, for those children, and for those of us who provide social services to be able to make sure that those families are getting the supports they need. It's been a huge challenge and a huge lift.
You know, remembering that a key piece of building resilience in children and in families, and if we think about and in parents, is a supportive relationship, and that includes for parents. And if parents and families are isolated, like we are in this pandemic, that supportive person, whoever that might be or might have been for a parent, if they're not accessible because of technology issues, because transportation, because of location, because of mental health or substance abuse issues, or, and on, that really compounds what families are experiencing in their home and kind of translating or having someone help carry the load of that stress.
That's Dara Williamson with the Early Childhood Group Ounce of Prevention and the Baby Fold's Karen Major speaking with Ryan Denham. This is Sound Ideas. I'm Charlie Schlenker. A new survey shows some troubling misconceptions about cannabis and its influence on traffic safety. The research comes from MAD, or Mothers Against Drunk Driving, with funding from State Farm. It finds 1 in 8 adults admits to driving under the influence of marijuana. It also found 6 in 10 people don't view driving while impaired by cannabis as a serious crime. And it shows parents are talking to their kids about drunk driving, but less often about driving after using cannabis. WGLT student reporter Cameron Kelly spoke to MAD National President Helen Witte about the research.
Because there's so many myths out there that are just wrong and dangerous. For example, like the, it's not dangerous to drive. I drive better after I've been taking cannabis. And that is so dangerous because innocent people are being killed and families are being shattered.
Is there a lot of research out there about cannabis-impaired driving already or not so much?
That's the problem. That a lot of states are legalizing this drug before all the research is out there. I mean, we know certain things. We know that marijuana impairs the brain and especially impairs the parts of the brain responsible for the way you move your body, for your balance, for your judgment. All these things are needed to drive. So there are certain things we know, but there are certain things that we still need to understand. Regarding alcohol, there was decades of research, and now MAD is pushing for more and more research and for understanding because too many people are dying.
How does this survey work and how many people have already responded to it?
The survey is mostly for information and to talk about what we know and what we don't know. We know certain things. I think we're getting great response. And that's the information. That's what we want to do is get the correct information, the life-saving information out there. Then people can make informed decisions. And if you make an informed decision, it may just save your life. I know firsthand because my daughter, who was 16, was rollerblading on a bike path on a bright and sunny afternoon. She was on her way home, close to our home, when she was run down by a girl who was drunk on alcohol and impaired also on marijuana, THC. My daughter looked up on that bike path, saw the car on the bike path spinning toward her, and there was nothing she could do but die. So I know that, and that, here's something key I want to say, is that what we do know is that the combination of alcohol and marijuana is even more deadly than the use of one. In fact, our survey shows that 1 in 3 young people who consume alcohol do it alongside at the same time with marijuana. And that's deadly. We know that that impairment is much higher.
Because that was one of my questions, was one more deadly than the other? But you explain that combined is even worse.
Is even worse. And because the research isn't there yet, you know, we know both are dangerous. So let's not quibble with lives. Both are dangerous. Let's get everyone home safe.
Cannabis being legal in so many states, including Illinois, will MAD change its name at some point because it is Mothers Against Drunk Driving? Drunk driving really doesn't capture the full, I mean, yes, that is the number one killer, as you were telling me. But, you know, like other things are also influencing drivers now, as in cannabis. So do you think that the name would change?
I think our name is so well known and understood that what we stand for, I can't see that happening. I certainly, of course, can't foretell. I love that question, actually. I can't foretell the future there. But I would say that we'll stand on our reliability and our integrity and what we stand for. Listen, alcohol is a drug. So is marijuana a drug? So Mothers Against Drunk Driving also could be Mothers Against Drugged Driving. I speak to people, well, is it going to be MADDD, you know, drunk and drug driving? I think it says it all.
You guys are funded by Bloomington State Farm. So what is it like working alongside an insurance company?
Well, State Farm has been a great help for us across the years. So we're very grateful for what they do. They have helped us with our underage drinking program and our underage drugged program. So they are our partners and our heroes. So we are grateful for their support, because that gets the information out there. That's what we need to do, is so that inform people so they can make the good, safe choice in life.
That's Mothers Against Drunk Driving National President Helen Witte speaking with WGLT student reporter Cameron Kelly. Thanks for choosing Sound Ideas on WGLT Normal, made possible with listener contributions at WGLT.org. I'm Charlie Schlenker. This is WGLT, Bloomington Normal's public media.